Astonishing Legends Network.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts and listeners on the Astonishing Dead Letter Office are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Astonishing Legends Productions, the Astonishing Legends Network, or any affiliated entities or guests.
When something unexplainable happens to you, it can make you feel isolated or alone. But trust us, you're not. For over a decade, you've been sending your strange stories to Astonishing Legends. And now it's time for our fellow Legenders to hear them too. Join us weekly in Blanket Fortiana as we dig through your intriguing messages to the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
Tonight's episode, The Boy Who Wanted Her Hand.
So we have a very dear friend that longtime listeners of the show, especially our main show, may have heard us mention before. She's been on the show on our Christmas specials. Her name is Allison Jornlin, and she co-owns a ghost tour company with her brother.
American Ghost Walks, which we highly recommend because we love and trust Allison to provide a wonderful experience with that. Also, she makes sure that the history is quite accurate and as best as they can because
she's
into that. She's a researcher, author, has written a lot about women and paranormal history as well, paranormal research.
That's right.
So she's quite an accomplished paranormal investigator with years of work under her belt and also an expert ghost tour researcher and a presenter and also a trainer of ghost tour guides.
I mean, she's not our guest tonight or anything,
this is
relevant. You're going to figure it out in a minute. But American Ghost Walks, they are in multiple states across the country. They were even on Shark Tank at one point. Alaska, California, Hawaii, Illinois, Louisiana, Maine, Minnesota, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, and Wisconsin, all on their webpage right now. She just got back from Alaska. I was talking to her the other day about that, setting up in Ketchikan, which I think we mentioned in another episode of the Dead Letter Office, which either is out now or will be out soon. Anyway,
the light in the water.
This is a fascinating field, the ghost walk, ghost tour companies, and Allison and her brother are particularly talented at finding out the real stories behind local events. All too often, you go on a ghost walk like this, and I just recently did one not too long ago in a city that will remain unnamed, and you can just tell these stories are being made up, exaggerated, or borrowed from famous events that actually took place in other cities. I've experienced this personally. I did research on the one I was just alluding to, and after I got home, I was like, oh, wow, that story was really cool, and I looked it up. And it had taken place in New York, which was not the city I was ghost walking in. So, you know, and who knows if it even started there, because I think when I looked that up, that it might have been borrowed from London. So there's a lot of that going on. These stories aren't built to help you win on Jeopardy, but you and I, Forrest, we love the real deal when it comes to the paranormal or as factual information as we can get, which is what's so cool about how Allison's company, American Ghost Walks, takes that. Which brings us to tonight's dead letter, which starts with a ghost walk tour.
Yeah, this is a good one. There's nothing like showing up for the initial rendezvous of one of these, which I've been on a few, you know, in the last few years here, and then waiting to get going as the dusk settles in. And there's a feeling of energy, too, and you're with people who are interested in this as well. So there's camaraderie, and if you're with friends, so much the better. And it's just, it's a lot of fun, and I highly recommend going on one. Because as the person, as the narrator, author in another one of our Dead Letter episodes says, it's a great way to find out some local history, but you'd have to do your own research as well. But they're just a lot of fun, and they're very exciting, especially if you don't know anything about the city.
Yes.
You know, so it's a very specific kind of feeling of excitement and one of the reasons we got into this business. Well, that's what happened tonight for our listener and Dead Letter sender, Mary. This story takes place in Key West, where she was visiting, and the guide she meets stands her group under an old marquee, walks across the narrow street, and asks them, "What do you think happened here?"
Exactly. Well, while the ghost walk story in this case may not have been entirely accurate, as far as we can tell, the kernel of it was very real, which is part of what makes this one so interesting. Forrest, you're reading tonight, so why don't you take us to Key West?
I've thought for some time about submitting this. I'm not sure if it rates a submission, but I've decided to send it anyway. Longtime listener, Patreon member, and I love the merch. A few years ago, I visited Key West with some friends. I often take ghost tours when I travel because it's a good way to hear about the history of a city and have some fun at the same time. Key West was no different. Our tour group was guided by an informative man, I'll call him Sam, who took us to a spot where there was one of the old half-moon-style movie marquees without markings. Sam asked us to stand under the marquee while he stood across the narrow street from us. "Now," he said, "someone tell me what happened here." I had no prior knowledge, that I'm aware of, related to the movie marquee or what I assumed was once a theater. However, I could smell smoke. Nervously, I spoke up and asked, "Was there a fire?" Sam verified that there was, indeed, a fire there at one point. He asked, "Anything else?" I immediately answered that there was a young woman with dark hair and children. No idea how I'm knowing this, mind you. Agreed, the chances of there being a young woman with dark hair and children in that building at some point are pretty high, but I pictured a particular young woman, in her 20s, with lots of kids around. I just felt them, especially her. Sam went on to tell us that at one time the building had been a church, and the young woman was married to the reverend. He thought she, a young Cuban woman in her 20s, was having an affair with one of the church deacons. One evening, he thought she was trysting with a lover after church, when, in fact, she was there with her Sunday school children. He locked and bolted the doors to the church and burned it down, kids and all. This is verifiable as having happened at St. Paul's Episcopal Church, but I couldn't find the name of the reverend or his wife. But my story doesn't end there. As I was standing, smelling smoke, before I knew what the story was, I felt a child on my left about hip level. Standing as shy children often do, half behind my dress, I was wearing a longish sundress, and half looking around at the other people. He wanted to take hold of my hand, but I didn't let him. I whispered that I was sorry, but he had to stay there because I had to go home and take care of my own little girl. Nothing much more happened that night, and I was happy that the little boy had not come away with me. However, the next night, more friends joined our friend group, and they wanted to do a ghost tour, so I went again. It was a different tour, with, of course, a different guide. This guide did not stop at the theater/church, but kitty-cornered across the street. There, the guide gave a few of us dowsing rods and proceeded to talk about dowsing and fresh water in the Keys. I had one of the rods, and rather than pointing down or doing nothing, my rod stood straight out and to the left, in the direction of the theater/church across the street where I'd felt the boy and smelled the smoke the night before. Nothing related has ever happened to me since then, so I don't believe anything followed me. I don't know if this story rises to the level of interesting, but it's definitely something that will always stick with me. Who knows what would have happened if I'd let that little guy take hold of my hand before I walked back across the street. Keep up the great work. You're the best out there. Our journey into the shadows continues after this brief break. Okay, so before we go on, you know, Mary's night starts about as far from ordinary life as you can get. Now, she's on vacation in Key West in the summer, walking Duval Street after dark with a tour guide and a pair of dowsing rods.
Which is a great way to spend a summer. And summer, when we were kids, meant freedom. No homework, no teachers, no school, right. And a lot of times no money. Sometimes you need to save money. And folks, some of that is still on the table because Mint Mobile's summer sale is on right now. And every plan is $15 a month, even unlimited.
Yeah, and Mint Mobile sure beats communicating with dowsing rods. It's a lot faster. But listen, you can keep your same phone, your same number, and the bill just stopped being something I think about. You know, and the service has been excellent.
Yeah, we both traveled all over the country with it now. We've had it many years, and we've never had coverage issues anywhere yet.
And you've had no problems even in the Four Corners region, right?
That's right. And you got to be careful in the Four Corners region. Not too far from Skinwalker Ranch, et cetera, et cetera. But here's the bottom line. Mint took what's wrong with wireless and made it right. Premium wireless for $15 a month. Unlimited talk and text, high-speed data, all on the nation's largest 5G network.
And switching is so easy. You just bring your current phone and your own number, and then you pick a 3, 6, or 12-month plan, and you get to say goodbye to that monthly bill.
You sign up online, and you're set. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/DLO. That's mintmobile.com/DLO.
Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/DLO. That's it. There's no catch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12 months plan required. $15 per month equivalent. Taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only.
Greater than 50 gigabytes may slow when network is busy. Includes up to 20 gigabyte hotspot. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies.
See mintmobile.com.
Let's get back to unraveling this dead letter.
All right, so that's Mary's letter. It's a pretty cool story. I want to start by saying this pretty plainly. What she felt standing under that marquee is hers. That's her personal experience. The smoke, the young woman, the little boy at her side reaching for her hand. We're not here to argue about any of that. We take people's personal experiences at face value.
That we do. And like I say about all paranormal experiences, it's extremely personal and often, I think, meant for that specific person that it's happening to.
Yes.
In whatever way you want to think about it. But it's also a lovely piece of writing on top of that.
Yeah.
It's that moment where she tells the boy she's sorry, but she has to get home to her own little child, her own little girl. And that's the kind of detail that stays with you.
Yes, it does. But you know how we are. We started pulling on the history that she was handed that night, the story that the guide told. And it turned into a little bit of a puzzle, kind of a fun one. It's the kind of stuff we love, actually.
Yeah, because we want to know as much of the real truth as can be found. And sometimes it's pretty murky, but what emerges is kind of a fun and quite interesting puzzle that happens here. So let's recap the guide's version. The building had been a church at one time. The reverend's young Cuban wife was suspected of having an affair with the one of the deacons there. And one night, the reverend unfortunately bolted the doors and burned the place down with her and a room full of Sunday school children inside.
And Mary, to her credit, tells us she went looking afterward and couldn't turn up that reverend's name or the wife's name.
Right.
I think maybe there's a reason for that. We went looking too, and that specific story, the locked doors, the wife, the children, it isn't out there anywhere that we could find anyway.
Right. And that's no knock on Mary or what she's telling us here. She's passing along exactly what she was told, the way any of us would on a tour. And it just solidifies the dubiousness of it, you know, that she couldn't find anything on that either.
Exactly. Now, here's what we did find, and it's its own kind of remarkable, really. There was a fire, a real and terrible one, on March 30th, 1886. The Great Fire of Key West started in a coffee shop on Duval Street. It burned for about 12 hours and destroyed most of downtown. 7 people lost their lives. And one of the buildings it took was a church, St. Paul's Episcopal, which is just about 2 blocks down, I think, on Duval Street there, from where I think Mary was standing when she was told this story.
Yeah, as best as we can find on Google Maps and do a little digital research here. And St. Paul's Church is still there. You can walk right up to it today.
Yeah, they have a lovely concert series on their website, which looks like amazing. Would love to go and check that out, actually. But here's the thing. St. Paul's, it's not the same building.
Yeah.
The church that burned in 1886, that was a wooden one. You can find pictures of it online, and we may get some posted with this episode.
Mm-hmm.
They rebuilt that one right after the fire, and then a hurricane took that one a couple of decades later. And the church standing on Duval Street in Key West now is a concrete one that they finished around 1919, which they built at that point that way on purpose so it would stop burning down or being such easy fodder for hurricanes. But essentially, same congregation, same corner since 1832, just not the same walls that burned down.
Right. And so, like many legends, there's often a kernel of truth in it. And in this case, there was a real fire at a real church that burned, and 7 real people who died. So all of that part is true.
Right. But they weren't locked in the church. That's the thing. Right. This is part that doesn't hold up, and is that there was a murder, the reverend, the bolted doors, the children. That all seems like it got added somewhere along the line. And there's actually a name for this kind of tale in folklore, the burnt church, where someone deliberately traps people inside. It's a story that turns up in folklore all over the country. And I was telling Forrest before we started recording, I remember it in at least one Clint Eastwood movie and maybe one or two other Westerns too.
Yeah.
But that is pinned to different towns and different versions. Like our favorite Lady in White, Resurrection Mary, this story travels. It gets around.
Yes, it does. And because it's a good setup, it's dramatic, it's tragic, it's got all the elements of a great legend or story. And you can see why human nature has it, that it gels into something like that, a mishmash over the years of retelling. Yeah. But you're right, that happens a lot in movies, like I said, because movies are a part of our collective cultural ledger of legends.
Yes.
I think it also happened in The Patriot, where British soldiers locked people in a church and burned it down. So I believe that is the case where that did happen. It's a horrible, awful, but expedient way to get rid of a lot of people at once. And people weren't opposed to doing that back then.
And here's where this really comes together when we started digging down on this, because we think we worked out the building that Mary might have been at when she heard this story on the ghost tour. She describes an old half-moon kind of movie marquee with no markings on it. From what we can tell, that points us quite possibly to what's called the Strand Theater at 527 Duval Street there in Key West.
It's a beautiful theater, as most of those old movie houses and theaters were, or was anyway.
It was a movie theater that opened in 1921. So think about that. That's pretty cool. That is 6 years before the first talkie, I believe, wasn't the jazz singer, 27?
Yeah. There's probably a piano player in there.
Yeah, exactly. It was pretty cool. But this building, it's gorgeous. You can look it up online. It's got an old Spanish style facade that's like super ornate. You could easily stand in front of it and look up at it and think, oh, that's an old church, because it looks like that.
Yeah.
But this building never was a church. It opened as a cinema, and then it spent the 90s as Ripley's Believe It or Not auditorium. That's ODT auditorium. And today, shocker, it's a Walgreens.
it's just a way of development and progress, I guess you could say.
Yes.
And the haunted church where the Reverend supposedly burned his congregation alive is now a Walgreens. Believe it or not. Believe it or not. Yeah, there you go.
I see what you did there. Well, yes, you can go in and buy sunscreen now in this building, but here's my take on this. I want to be careful. This is the two of us raising it out and not us claiming mystery solved or anything,
right.
But there's a handful of real things that seem like they might have gotten braided together within a couple of blocks here on Duval Street. You've got this theater that looks a lot like a church, and then you've got an actual church that did burn down just two blocks away. You've got the 1886 fire, which accounts for the fire part of the story. It started right on that same stretch next to the San Carlos Institute, which, according to our research, was the heart of Cuban Key West at the time. And there are some implications that there may have been political reasons that fire was started, possibly arson, not necessarily about murder, but about influencing people who were backing, I think, cigar makers who were backing the Cuban Revolution at the time.
Yeah, right, right.
So that connects too with a sort of a planned arson thing that might have led to some deaths, but that's not the same thing as a torrid affair and locking people inside a building and burning it to the ground. And I want to reiterate here, we might be wrong about the Strand, but that's the closest building we can figure down there that has a movie marquee that matches this sort of description that Mary sent us.
Right. And Mary herself says, I couldn't find anything either, remember, and is just enjoying the story that was delivered to her, and it's entertaining. But like I said, with all things, you have to look into it yourself and make your own assessments. In this sense here, you do have a fire, there's a Cuban community, and a church that burned, and all of this is true. They just got pulled together onto the wrong building, perhaps, with a murder, added on for the chill factor and just the tragedy of it. Because again, that's drama.
I mean, that's where I'm landing on it. And to be clear, none of this is a strike against that particular tour guide or company. We set it up top. These stories are storytelling first, just like the ones I mentioned that I went on. It was storytelling, albeit stories from New York that supposedly took place in North Carolina. But hey, Right. Legends drift. They pick up drama, they find an evocative building, like in this case, and they settle in. Now, the best tour operators, like our friend Allison and her brother Mike, they work really hard to keep the real history straight. But the tradition itself of ghost walks and ghost tours runs a little bit on embellishment. And there's nothing wrong with that. People go out and they want to hear the spooky stories. It's like, well, you don't get on the roller coaster because you want to feel like you're riding in a safe car at 35 miles an hour.
I myself experienced a similar thing with a story from a ghost walk tour guide, which was perhaps embellished. I've mentioned this before, but only once, so I don't feel that bad about retelling the story. But this happened when we had that fateful trip to New Orleans. We went on a ghost walk in the French Quarter at night, and that's where you feel that feeling. It was so cool.
Us of all the together. Places to do a ghost walk.
Great. It's so rich and rife, and where you feel like you don't have to embellish stuff, but you know what? The tour guide, and again, no shade on them because I'm not sure where they're getting these stories, but it's entertaining. That's what I paid for. But if you want to believe in history, like, you got to research yourself. And he was talking about one particular building in the French Quarter, I think even on a corner, that now is, I think it's some kind of lounge. There's glass walls. But he said, his story that he relayed was that, you know, at one time in the wild history of the city, this building was owned by none other than the son of the Count of Saint Germain. And as we all know, Saint Germain supposedly had an elixir or process to elongate life and cheat death and never grew old and knew all things, as Voltaire said, but later we learned he was being sarcastic. The man who knows all things and never dies. Eye roll. And then Voltaire eye roll.
And if you want to know more about the Count of Saint Germain, we did a series on him on Astonishing Legends. You can find it. Just look it up. Yes.
And so the story goes was that the son of Saint Germain had this secret or whatever, but it involved drinking human blood. And this cadre, this small coven, a collective of New Orleans wealthy and knowledgeable insiders and a secret club would gather together at the stroke of midnight or whatever and, you know, drink blood and keep themselves living longer. However, having done this series ourselves and looking into it, I don't recall Saint Germain ever having a child of any kind.
Specifically a vampiric child.
Supposedly, that was one of the things about him. He never married, didn't have a wife or even a paramour of any kind, and thus no children, legitimate or illegitimate, and his methods never involved drinking blood. So that was never mentioned, but makes a good story, and that's the point. It just made cool story. They're drinking blood, all these Illuminati people, and they're doing these things at this specific building. Now, the counterpoint to that is that a lot of weird crap has gone down in New Orleans of a very unsavory nature, lots of it involving blood, just not perhaps this story that we were being told, but it was entertaining. We all kind of, our little group kind of like side-eyed each other and snickered, but it was enjoyable. And that's the point, but just don't rely on this for a book report for school. Right. That's also the point. So if I've experienced that. And this is the other part of that, though, talking about personal experiences. Perhaps one of the most important parts of this is that this is a personal experience that no one else will feel.
Yeah.
You may believe the person wholeheartedly and earnestly, but you'll never feel what they felt. And I mean the sensations, the smell of the smoke, the touch of the child. That's incredibly intimate and personal, like all these experiences. And none of this reframes what Mary experienced herself, is the point. The history being tangled, you know, doesn't make the smoke she smelled any less real or the child any less of a ghost or a spirit that was actually there. Those are two completely separate paranormal questions there. And so we should keep that separate between what the actual history is and what the person experienced or goes on to. And remember the Conjuring story where supposedly the ghost of the alleged witch that was hanging there near the house or whatever. This is what I love about the story because it kind of lines up with this is that you might have some debunkers saying like, well, that person never actually died in that house. That never happened there. So it couldn't be her ghost. No way.
Right.
However, that actual woman was hanged a few houses down.
Right.
So it did happen, but like just not there. Does that really matter?
She was conveniently nearby. Yeah.
do ghosts care? Can they move around? I remember one psychic medium saying, like, people say, like, well, that can't be that ghost because they didn't die in that house. She goes, what do you think? They can't move around?
Yeah,
of course they can move around.
She's been trying to get an Uber for a millennia.
Right. So. Well, yeah. So you might be the Uber because they can hitch a ride, which also is a factor in our story tonight. She knew Mary not to encourage any attachments, which is probably a smart thing to do.
Well, and there's a second half to Mary's trip there on a different evening, the very next evening. She went on a different tour, different guide. This one, they didn't stop at the marquee. They set up a kitty corner, as you say in the P&W forest, and caddy corner.
No, hold on. I think that I've heard it all ways. Yeah, caddy corner.
Well, we say caddy corner here in the
kitty
South.
Corner or kitty as like a child.
I've never heard kitty
corner.
Yeah, I don't like those. They're not.
Yeah, we also don't say pig in a poke or grab a tonic or all these other Southern colloquialisms.
None of those are any expressions I have heard anywhere. We don't even say kakalaki, which you constantly say to me.
Oh, you introduced that to me. I never heard about that. It's like, oh, yeah,
no, it's like a bumper sticker from the barbecue place here. But anyway, they were kitty corner or caddy corner across the street from where she'd been before. And everyone in this particular group got a pair of dowsing rods and started talking about dowsing for fresh water down there in the Keys.
Yeah, I've also used those on ghost hunts in theaters, actually, a couple times, and it's fascinating. Sometimes you get uncanny answers to your questions,
which seem
to be in context. And of course, those more skeptical would say, like, well, you're actually doing that subconsciously if you're moving at all. So
take it how you will.
But we've talked about dowsing a ton over the years, which is essentially the old water witching tradition. So most people know it by the folk practice of trying to find underground water. And you need a pair of bent rods, sometimes a forked stick. What I've heard is that you want a fresh, wet piece of willow in a Y configuration. That works good. But you want a dry stick. And when you cross over water underground, it will start to point down.
Right.
I don't know how that works, but there's all kinds of things you can use for dowsing. Basically, just a bent pair of rods, and it'll answer your question by crossing. So, the other story I like because I'd heard this often and I've not heard it discounted is that GIs, military infantrymen in Vietnam, would use dowsing to try and find landmines. Now, you want that one to work specifically, I think, and I've not heard of, but I've heard that that is true, but I don't know how, what the efficacy is that, or percentage of that working. But when you don't have a metal detector, better than just kind of stomping around seeing what happens.
Hey, I know for a fact of well drilling companies here in North Carolina that use dowsing to pick the spots to try to find wells for people on their land, so.
And apparently you would think if it never worked, people would stop doing it. Or even if you say like, well, it's like anything else, psychic ability, it happens or is accurate 20 to 30% of the time. That's still not good enough to keep on doing it, in my estimation. But the idea when you're on a ghost hunt and you have the rods is that you ask a question. And if the answer is yes, the rods will cross over them. If the answer is no, they separate and go other ways. Now, Mary's case, the rod pointed to the theater where this happened. Yeah.
Right. It's pointing back to the theater where she smelled the smoke, where she felt that little boy. Of course, now in her mind, I guess she thought the theater used to be the church that burned down, which we're saying, well, that was actually two blocks down the street and that whole story wasn't quite right, but that church did burn down. So this is all like, it's mixing up. It's interesting that's reconnecting to the dowsing experience she's having the next night. But I think the question that comes out of this is, what did she encounter or experience? If we believe her personal experience, which we do, we're supportive of that, then the story that was all wrapped around this was possibly fabricated for drama, then what was she encountering? What did she cross paths with? And this a little bit, reminds me of like the possibility of something conjured in a way to bring up something you mentioned earlier, but you think about the Philip experiment or just this idea. We talked about this before with the Myrtles plantation. I believe there was a ghost at the Myrtles that people have pretty much definitively proven as best they can. It was a person that never existed, but it's been talked about so much. It's even been photographed, I believe, this ghost.
Yeah.
And this is something we've touched on over the years, the idea that we're kind of manifesting these tulpas or these types of things that are associated with stories, even if the stories are fabricated. And the Philip experiment proves that that can happen.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because on that same trip to New Orleans, we also went to the Myrtles Plantation.
Oh, okay.
And went on that tour guide. Now, that's the other thing is that because it's a ongoing attraction with a lot of guests, I would tend to believe those stories a little bit more as far as historical accuracy is concerned. And the guide themselves would say, like, well, this is, we have no proof of this, or this is not very well verified, but these are the ongoing stories. And they say, this is what we do know about the history of the plantation.
Right.
Such as there being one, I believe this is connected to Myrtles, where there was a woman who was one of the owners or people at the time who was in charge, and it was a woman who was just very evil and had unfortunately, a slave woman chained up to the stove or the kitchen, actually, just to stay there and cook. And that, again, I can't remember if that's actually true or not, but, you know, that type of story. Now, to your point, if you say, like, well, there's a military man there and he haunts the mirror that's in the hall, and there is a giant mirror there. I took a bunch of photos, saw nothing. But there's another interesting, more personal story, which is what we're talking about with Mary here, experience in that I took a picture of the dining room there, I believe, and one of our friends that was there was in the photo. And I just sent the photo to two psychic mediums that we know, two separate people who don't know each other, but claim that they can see things in photos. And one said, well, there's somebody standing on the stairs. He's a middle-aged or older gentleman, and he's wearing a military uniform, and that's all I'm getting. The second person also said the same thing. There's somebody in uniform standing there. I don't know if he's with the house or lived there, but he's just standing on the stair, and the same part of the stair they both described. And they also said, there's a woman in that photo, and there's a black kind of a mist or cloud that's kind of hanging over her, maybe also kind of connected to her. I said, well, that's interesting. And the other psychic said the same thing. That woman in the photo wearing the specific outfit, yeah, there's a kind of a black cloud kind of hanging over her.
Oh, right.
So that was fascinating when totally unsolicited and they don't know each other and unprompted. So who knows?
Yeah.
But anyway, that's some of the legends about like the Myrtles and those stories that rise up. But I think any good historian or ghost tour guide will point out which things are more unknown or like, well, this is speculative, but it may or may not have happened. But that's one of the legends because I'm more concerned or interested in just what are the legends that surround this place, because I like the stories and I don't need to, again, I'm not writing a research paper. I just want to hear the cool stories, and I'll find out later for myself if I'm that interested, whether it's likely to have happened or not. So, but there are certainly many other stories that have happened concerning fires in theaters that unfortunately is an ongoing thing, especially kind of around the same time. And one you may have heard of, Scott, because it involves somebody I think your wife knows quite well, and that is Saturday Night Live alum Anna Gasteyer.
Yes, Anna does have a really good story about the theater in Chicago. She's been performing on Broadway forever. She was in Wicked. She currently was just nominated for a Tony for Schmigadoon, which she's in right
now. That's right.
So you ran down that article where Anna talks about this particular fire, right, in Chicago?
I just happened to be watching The Late Show with Stephen Colbert on CBS doing an interview, and she told this story.
Yeah.
So here's the background on it, and I'm going to relay this story about the Chicago theater fire because it's the worst in history, at least U.S. history.
Yeah.
So this comes from a CBS News article, October 31st, of course, 2021, titled Chicago Hauntings, The Horrors of the Iroquois Theater Fire That Killed 602 People Downtown in 1903, and the Stories About Ghosts Left Behind. So I'm just going to skim through and read a few interesting parts of this. So it starts off, 571 lives were destroyed by fire in the Iroquois Theater in the 15 minutes between 3:15 and 3:30 o'clock yesterday afternoon, reads a Chicago Tribune article from Thursday, December 31st, 1903. It goes on, of the dead, less than 100 were identified last night. Of the unidentified, nearly all were so badly burned that recognition was impossible. Only by trinkets and burned scraps of wearing apparel will the bodies of hundreds be made known to their families.
Right.
End of that passage. The article goes on. The number was not final. A total of 602 patrons died in the fire at the Iroquois Theater at 24-28 West Randolph Street downtown that chilly Wednesday, December 30th. By contrast, an estimated 300 people died in the Great Chicago Fire of 1871.
Right, which is more, it's a more famous fire by,
a I more famous fire, but this is twice the death count, sadly.
You know, there's also the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in New York.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
I think that was way less people than either one of these that passed in that, so.
Right, and to your other salient point here, reading about the spurious story, history of the theater in question, tonight's story, the article goes on, at the time of the fire, the Iroquois Theater had only been open 6 weeks. As the Encyclopedia of Chicago tells us, theaters have been burning down throughout the 19th century only to be rebuilt and then burned down again. So you can see, like, we're going to switch to stone. Maybe that's a better idea. We're getting tired. This is very dangerous. Yeah. Quote, from the first Chicago Theater, built by John Blake Rice in 1847 and rebuilt following a fire 3 years later, through the Great Fire of 1871 and until the end of the century, fire kept Chicago's theaters in a state of constant regeneration, not unlike the surrounding Illinois prairie, the encyclopedia says. So there's another gentleman here, Tony Zabelski of Chicago Hauntings, Ghost Tours, goes on with the article to explain more about it. So when they built it, of course, with the hubris, they thought the new Iroquois was billed as absolutely fireproof, end quote.
There we go, so, just like the Titanic. Unsinkable.
Well, the CBS News article goes on to explain just what happened during that fire, and it's really tragic and you know, heart-wrenching. Just a horrible tragedy, especially with so many people involved, but it gives a great detail of what exactly happened. As it was known then, the article goes on to say, the fire remains the single deadliest single building fire in terms of loss of life in American history, and the single deadliest theater fire in the world, Zabelski notes, and that's the tour guide. So pretty significant. Well,
yeah,
the theater actually didn't actually burn down. It went on not too long afterward to reopen as the Colonial Theater, and then was torn down in 1925 to make way for the present building that's on the site now. So the building was originally called the Oriental Theater. That opened in 1926. So we're around the same time here, 1921, 1926. It was also a grand movie palace, hosted stars such as Judy Garland, the Three Stooges, Al Jolson, Duke Ellington.
There we go.
But that theater closed down in 1981, and then it reopened in 1998 as the Ford Center for the Performing Arts at the Oriental Theater. And so that then changed in 2019 from the Oriental Theater to being called the Niederlander Theater in honor of Broadway theater owner and producer James M. Niederlander. The article continues, the Niederlander, back when it was still the Ford Center for the Performing Arts at the Oriental, also played host to a record-breaking run of the show Wicked. One-time cast member Anna Gasteyer, a Saturday Night Live alumna, appeared on the show Celebrity Ghost Stories, that's the other place that she talks about it, to talk about what she thought were experiences with the paranormal. So Gasteyer said what is now the Niederlander was steeped in glamour, but also described it as being dingy, dusty, and a drafty quality about it. She described the alley behind it, known as Death's Alley from the Iroquois Fire, as a place that, quote, always had the gloomiest, darkest, most dismal. It was a terrible alley. It really was. It felt terrible, end quote.
Yeah.
And in 2005 and 2006, Gasteyer played Elphaba, the Wicked Witch of the West, in Wicked at the then Oriental. At the end of Act One, she notes in Celebrity Ghost Stories that there is a climactic moment in which the witch is learning to fly and a huge amount of smoke and fog envelops the auditorium as the orchestra soars. While, quote-unquote, flying, Gasteyer reported she would look out to the sides and see people in the wings. She said there was a lot of stagehands on the production, but this was more people than should have been there. She said they were gathered, quote, almost like families, gatherings of people that were together, end quote. But then once she landed, there wouldn't be anybody there. She also reported hustling down the hallways between from her dressing room in which her witch dress was stored with no one around, and reported first hearing a child's voice. She said she turned a corner and found a woman at the end of the hall near the stairwell. The woman was with two children, a boy and a girl. All were in turn-of-the-last-century period dress. Gasteyer says, quote, "My first kind of instinct was just kind of a backstage instinct. Oh, there's another actor." I nodded, and the woman was very stoic. She didn't smile. She nodded back, Gasteyer said on the show. And when she turned another corner, the woman and child were gone, Gasteyer said. And she said when she asked her dresser about it, the dresser noted that the December 30th date was coming up and suggested they were ghosts from the Iroquois fire.
Wow.
So there you go. That's I remember that story stuck with me because I'm not sure if she said she smelled smoke, but just that, at first, so it's like, oh, there's another production going on. There's other actors here. They must be getting ready to rehearse or something or, failing after us. But then she comes down from the wire rigging and there's nobody there in the wings. Here's the other interesting note. Again, I love the details about this is that the woman with the children, supposedly the ghost woman and ghost children, she was stoic. She didn't smile, but she nodded so she could see Anna. And I wonder what the ghost people, they must have seen lots of productions over the years, free theater.
Yeah.
So, but how is she connecting with Anna? Like she nodded and the ghost woman nods back. So there's a connection there that it's not just a stone tape theory kind of recurring reflection of somebody past.
Right. Echo or just a crisis apparition or.
That's right. They were most likely there. And I believe that can happen. So there you go. A woman, children, tragic fire. But that story we know actually happened in a very tragic and large way. And they have not left the theater. They're still there. And here's my point is I think it's often a combination of being in the right place at the right time, but also having a vibe, openness vibe to this kind of stuff, being not exactly welcoming it, but being open to the experience. Because I've heard this also, speaking of psychic mediums, that when the past loved one tries to send a message to somebody, I've heard this again and again, and I find it fascinating. The past loved one has a message that they want to relay. And often it's just, I love you and I'm fine.
Yeah.
Don't worry, I'll see you one day.
Yeah.
But they can't deliver that message to the person because of their state. And it could be too much grief, just a personal disbelief in it, or just a closed off, or just, wherever you're at vibrationally, no wrong or right in that. It's just where you're at. And there's other people, though, that they're more able to communicate with. And so I've heard a handful of stories from people I know where a message from the departed was delivered to somebody else, generally that psychic person.
Yeah.
And they then had, I just talked about this, I think in another DLO where just like total stranger walks up to you. He's like, I know this sounds really weird. I know you're not going to believe this. I'm sorry if it's upsetting, but I have somebody here who's telling me you need to hear something.
Yeah. Yeah.
One story that reminds me of this scenario is it's an Instagram clip, I think, coming from a podcast hosted by two Australian guys who I think talk about the paranormal. I'm sorry, I don't know the show, but they were asked what story has stuck with you the most as being the most profound or creepiest or something. And the one guy relayed a story that came into them about a young man whose father, I think, or maybe uncle had passed away recently, but they made a pact that they would deliver a message, whoever went first, and of course the father or uncle was older, that they would try to relay a message from the other side. And this woman had gone to a bar and was whooping it up, having drinks and dancing and enjoying the music. And then she had this urge to tell somebody something. And she turned to this guy and she said, I'm sorry, I know this is so weird, but I can't get this out of my head that I have to tell you that my leg really hurts. And the guy just kind of lost it. And as it turns out, she goes, I know that sounds so weird and I know I've been drinking or whatever, but like, I have to tell you this message. Does that mean anything? And the guy lost it. He said, yeah, that's the non sequitur phrase my dad and I agreed that would be the message.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so that's what I'm talking about is sometimes these messages come indirectly. Now, I'm sure the father would want to tell the son directly, but for some reason, that didn't happen. Okay. He found someone else who could be more receptive to the communication, and they told the person.
It's fascinating to me getting to the root of the real story here and trying to figure out what may have happened. And honestly, we're speculating on whether or not she was in front of the Strand. That's a guess.
But right,
we looked
right at
the church on Street View. There's no marquee kind of situation there of any type. So I feel like maybe she was a couple blocks down in front of the Strand and the story was told the way it was. And this is one thing you and I talked about too, that it could be that the ghost walk, if they're telling this story about the murder, that it's a little bit apocryphal and the church being burned down and this horrible thing happening there. I could see why you might not want to tell that story in front of an active church that has a congregation that's been going to
right
hundreds of years. So,
not good PR. Yeah.
So maybe you go down and you tell that story at the theater that looks kind of like a church. I don't know, but here's the thing. This is the thing about Mary's story. She smelled smoke and experienced these other people being there, these spirits being there before she heard any of that.
Right.
Before she heard about the fire, before she knew any of those things. She thought she smelled smoke and she sensed who these people were. I'm curious to know when she encountered these spirits, if they were connected to the fire somehow, but there's probably been a lot of unfortunate deaths in that area since then. And Key West itself leans very much into its haunted past. Robert the Doll, all of that stuff.
Oh,
it's
yeah
got a record. So, and that's part of its cachet and part of what people go. It's just like New Orleans and you doing the ghost walks in New Orleans. What better place to do that? You do it. That's why you go to Savannah. That's why you go wherever. So there's places where you expect to get these deep dive ghost walks. And whatever the case is with the factual information that maybe backs this up and whether these things have been created by thousands of people hearing that story and thinking that that's what it was, or it was just misinterpreted relationship between real events and what she connected with, we can't say. That's the real question. So for me, that's the part of this we don't get to solve. Whatever she experienced, it's clearly left a lifelong impression on her. So, Mary, thank you so much for sending your letter into the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
The Astonishing Dead Letter Office is hosted by Scott Philbrick and Faris Burgess and is executive produced by Tess Feifel. The show is edited and mixed by Sarah Voorhees-Wendell at VW Sound. The theme is based on the Astonishing Legends theme by Judson Crane at Founder Music, arranged by Alan Carissia, who composes all the other music in the show. Tommy Beaver Design created the logo. The announcer is John Bowler. That's me. Stories are lightly edited for length, content, and readability, but otherwise presented as they're sent to us. We're always looking for more dead letters, so if you have a story of your own you'd like to share, email it to deadletteroffice@astonishinglegends.com. Please include how you would like to be credited. First name only, first name last initial, anonymous, a pseudonym. Let us know. Due to the number of emails coming in, we often cannot respond, but we do read them all. No part of this show may be reproduced anywhere without permission. Copyright Astonishing Legends Productions.